We'd like to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. It's nice to have you with us this afternoon. We have two cases on our docket, one at 1:30. Then we'll do a brief recess to take up the case at 3 p.m. this afternoon because we have a change in panel members. The first case is 2-15-103-CV, Texas Ethics Commission versus Michael Quinn Sullivan. I believe everyone's checked in with our clerk, but if you will please introduce which counsel are speaking today. Thank you. All right, Mr. Nichols.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. This appeal concerns two principal issues. First, the first important issue is whether a respondent on a final order of the Texas Ethics Commission can create venue in a county such as Denton County by renting an apartment in Denton County after the commission enters its final order. The second important issue in the case, from the commission's perspective, is does the TCPA apply to an appeal from a commission final order? And even if it does the voluminous record that we see that went before the trial court here, which included affidavits and an extensive record of evidence developed before the commission during its agency process, satisfy any requirement under the TCPA of a showing, a prima facie showing of clear and specific evidence? There are other issues that have been briefed and argued by the parties, but from our standpoint, these are the two issues that I'd like to address with the court's permission during my argument. First, with respect to the venue issue, as this court is well aware from its prior decisions, a court of appeals such as this one are not shy or reluctant to, on mandamus or in a direct appeal such as this, to find that the evidence does not support a holding of venue in a particular county. There are a series of cases that have come out of this court. I believe the chief has been involved in writing some of those. The KJ Eastwood Investments case, In Re SJS, In Re Fincher. We've cited those to the court. All those involve cases in which this court has in effect granted a writ of mandamus conditionally and directed the trial court to transfer venue to a county of proper venue. So what does this record show that the court has already looked at and reviewed? What does this record show about the relevant venue law and facts?
Before you get to what the record shows, what is your position on the standard that we use in this determination?
It's definitely an abuse of discretion standard,
Didn't it even go so far to say if there's any probative evidence to support the trial court's ruling that we must affirm on that, even if a preponderance of the evidence might prove to the contrary?
It's definitely not a preponderance test, so, and we're not arguing that. And our argument, as you well know, Justice Gabriel, is twofold. Number one, we do not believe that the evidence put before the trial court by Mr. Sullivan in this case even rose to the level of establishing the prima facie case of venue, number one. And number two, even if that were the case, then there have been arguments made that somehow that there's no need for the trial court or even an appellate court to look at the other evidence that's put into the record. And as this court knows full well, we cited a very important case out of the Supreme Court, the In Re Missouri Pacific Railroad case. And in that case, the plaintiff sued a railroad in a particular county on grounds that the plaintiff claimed that there was a principal office for that railroad in a particular county. Now, if the rule was that by a plaintiff saying that, that that's enough in a prima facie case, then that the case would have ended there. But in that case, the Supreme Court went further and said, we got to look at the evidence that's out there. You got to look at the full record of what's in the file before the trial court. And in this case, we respectfully submit that the record shows as follows, that between September 2013 and August 2014, Mr. Sullivan filed four lawsuits against the Ethics Commission in Travis County. In each of those lawsuits, he alleged in court filings that he was a resident of Travis County. 4 days before he filed this lawsuit in Denton County, he filed an amended pleading in one of those Travis County suits, which is still pending, that said, I am a resident of Travis County. He then filed the Denton County suit, said flatly in there, his allegation was that Sullivan is an individual who resides in Denton County, Texas. And when the commission asked Mr. Sullivan to provide evidence of his Denton County residency, he produced an apartment rental contract and emails about that apartment rental. Well, it turns out upon examination of that evidence that all the email traffic about renting an apartment, as well as the lease contract itself, occurred after the commission issued its final order on July 21st, 2014. In essence, our position is that the record shows that there was an effort to scramble to create venue in some place other than Travis County nearly a month after the commission issued its final order.
And is it your position that this evidence was really unrebutted?
Yes. And the only thing that, I mean, given all due credit to what the record is, and this goes to Justice Gabriel's question too, what we got in response to all the evidence that we put in before the trial court was a half-page affidavit. And so the court has to look at that affidavit, has to take Mr. Sullivan's affidavit into account in determining whether or not that gives rise to, as Justice Gabriel, as you were mentioning, whether that gives rise to any kind of prima facie case of a venue in Denton County. And we do not believe that it does, because that affidavit, that half page, basically says three things. First, it says it's a conclusion. I am a resident of Denton County. Second, it says I've rented an apartment in Denton County, and I have worked in a North Texas office. Third thing it says is my parents live in Denton County, and before I rented the apartment, I considered their home to be my residence, and I had a right of access. And for reasons that come from the core venue case law in this state, including Snyder v. Pitts, those three statements, conclusory statements, do not give rise to venue facts, prima facie venue facts for Denton County. We've talked about the issue of the apartment. With respect to a conclusion that I am a resident of Denton County, that's like the statement that came out of the Missouri Pacific case, which said they have a principal office in that county. You can't rely on a conclusion like that. You have to produce evidence, as the Supreme Court indicated in the Missouri Pacific case. And the third part is the parents living in Denton County. There's a reason why in this state we don't see a whole lot of venue cases where people are claiming venue in a particular county based on the fact that their parents live there. And this does go back to the core elements of Snyder v. Pitts that we mentioned earlier. As a reminder, the three Snyder elements are as follows. First, a fixed, that's the word used, fixed place of abode in possession of a party. That's the first element. Second, occupied consistently over a substantial period of time. Second element. Third element, permanent rather than temporary. And it is for the very foundation of venue law in the state of Texas why there are not folks who would stand up before a court and say, I have venue in a county where my parents live and where I go to visit. It just does not happen. And finally, with respect to the venue issue, it is critically important that we weigh the venue facts as of the time the commission entered its final order. That is an uncontested matter of law that, as this court well knows, that venue facts are determined as of the time the cause of action accrues. Things that happen after the cause of action accrues cannot and do not form the basis of a claim of venue in a particular county. The second major issue that I want to address during my time with the court is the issue of the TCPA and its application to this case. This court has already dealt with some other issues under the TCPA. The Lipsky case came out of this court, and so this is not the first time that this court has had to grapple with a question of first impression under the TCPA. Our respectful position is that under a pure statutory interpretation evaluation of the statute, that the TCPA was not intended by the legislature to apply to de novo appeals from commission final orders, or any agency's orders for that matter. In a nutshell, our argument is that there is nothing in the statute that indicates that the legislature contemplated that the TCPA would apply to appeals like this one. As the Lipsky, as the Supreme Court said in the Lipsky decision that came out, which basically affirmed this court's rulings with a little bit of a wrinkle, it's not relevant here. The Supreme Court said in Lipsky, as this court had indicated, that the TCPA was truly intended to deal with situations where an individual or a business file a claim for such things as libel, business disparagement, in which they are basing those claims on statements or the exercise of First Amendment rights by the defendant. And the defendant in that private suit, the language in the statute being a claim for legal or equitable relief, that a plaintiff, such as that person or business entity, seeking a claim for legal or equitable relief, then the TCPA is used to file a motion to dismiss and have a court determine whether the plaintiff in the case can show a prima facie case of clear and specific evidence. That
let me ask you something there, if
yes,
I may,
yes.
Mr. Nichols. Is there any provision, or have you all seen anybody filing in a response to an action by the TEC? At the administrative level, has anybody raised a claim under the TCLPA?
Actually, it's a very good question, Chief, because there was, if I recall correctly, I don't want to speak outside the record, but I don't think it's going to be controverted, that there was an effort to make such an argument before the commission here. But there is, as the court knows, there is an explicit exception within the statute that would cause the TCPA not to apply in those contexts, but that certainly is something that to answer your question has been raised before. The closest we get to any kind of explicit statutory language is the exception in the statute for what are called enforcement actions. Now that provision of the TCPA appears to be drafted to address cases such as, for example, if the Attorney General's office were to bring a DTPA type claim against an individual and seek some type of civil penalties, that the statute makes clear that is carved out of the TCPA. But the kind of thinking that is embedded in that provision, our point is, indicates that it was not legislative intent to have the TCPA apply to appeals from agency actions. In fact, the policy, the TCPA, as the court knows from looking at the Lipsky case and other cases, it actually has a policy section in it. And that's section 27002. And that policy section explicitly refers to balancing against, quote, the rights of a person to file meritorious lawsuits for demonstrable injury, which kind of dovetails into that concept that the TCPA only applies to cases involving claims for legal or equitable relief. This is not such a case. This is a situation where the commission has been charged by state law explicitly by the provisions of the government code to enforce certain laws, including the sunshine laws that we're dealing with here that relate to lobbyist registration. And so in this case, we do not have a lawsuit for demonstrable injury, but instead we have an administrative agency proceeding that the legislature has provided an appeal from, a de novo appeal to district court. So for all those reasons and the reasons that were indicated in the Lipsky case by this court and the Supreme Court, if the TCPA is intended for private lawsuits designed to chill First Amendment rights, this, what we're dealing with here, is not such a case. And so, in summation, we encourage the court to decide this issue. Since originally we came up before the court on a mandamus, we're here now on a direct appeal because of the order that was entered dismissing the case, even though, as we point out, that the replacement judge for the recused trial judge noted right before he signed the order, quote, "I don't think the case ought to be dismissed." We would ask the court to, given the current posture of the case and to set a precedent for future cases, to address the issue of whether the TCPA applies and find that it does not, and therefore reverse that order of the trial court dismissing the case and also remanding the case to the trial court with direction to transfer the matter to Travis County. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Nichols. All right, for the appellee, Mr. Nixon will argue.
May it please the court. I'd like to make 3 points. The first is the venue was correctly decided to be in Denton County. The second one is the trial court correctly dismissed the case. And the third was the only mistake the trial court made was failing to award any attorney's fees when the statute made the award of attorney's fees mandatory. In dealing with venue, it's very specific and it's very clear that the record contains uncontroverted prima facie evidence of venue facts in Denton County.
Do you agree that the venue facts have to address the time that the cause of action accrued, which in this case was July 21st of 2013?
No. Mr. Sullivan doesn't have a cause of action. The cause of action belongs to the Ethics Commission. That analysis is misapplied in this case. What Mr. Sullivan has is a right of appeal pursuant to Chapter 571.133 of the Texas Government Code. And in that's the only venue statute we have here. And it says the respondent has the right of appeal to appeal to either Travis County or the county in which the respondent resides, present tense. It's wide open. So you appeal where you reside, and you know with
that would still be on the same date, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be when that right to appeal accrued, on the date that the final order was entered?
Well, the choice to appeal is the key date, because the statute says is present tense. There is no law that says, and there's no case law that says, that you must reside at the time that the statute. At the time of the final order. That's not what the statute says.
But when even he filed his appeal on that date, is it your position that it would be on that date that we need to be looking at to the venue facts?
I think that, yes. I would urge the court to consider the date on which the appeal is filed. Now, if the court doesn't want to do that, then the court would like to go back and read the affidavit of Mr. Sullivan that said, I have been a resident of Denton County for more than a year. I've been living out of my parents' house while coming to Denton County for work.
Does that comport with his 4 days prior to filing his notice of appeal amending his pleadings in Travis County saying he was a Travis County resident?
Well, the Snyder versus Pitts, the very cases on which the commission relies, says that, and it's been a long time, the law of the state that a person may have more than one residence. There's no requirement that you are limited to one residence for venue. We apply that to corporate defendants routinely, allowing plaintiffs to choose. Mr. Sullivan exercised his rights under the statute to pick Denton to file his appeal in Denton County, a county in which he resides. And I think it's very important for the court to take note of the fact that none of those facts are controverted or argued with by the commission. If the commission said Mr. Sullivan's parents don't live in Denton County, or Mr. Sullivan hasn't been a resident of Denton County, Mr. Sullivan doesn't have an office up here that he works out of. The venue facts asserted by Mr. Sullivan in his affidavit are much stronger than those that were asserted in Snyder versus Pitts, where a businessman went to, from the Dallas area, went to West Texas and worked out of a hotel, essentially, a boarding house. When a contract became an issue, they sued him in the West Texas county and said, your boarding house has become your second residence. The defendant in Snyder versus Pitts says, no, I don't want to have a venue. I don't want to have a residence there. In that case, the Supreme Court said, you can have more than one residence, and that's enough facts. Those are enough facts to have venue. The venue facts here are much greater than those in Snyder versus Pitts. And I would urge the court to consider like Mills versus Bartlett, where the Supreme Court said venue is a very elastic standard. It's very easy. It's the standard of creating a residence is very, very easy. Easy to meet. We don't want to go back and have the old plea of privilege trials where the old venue where everybody tries a case through the venue deal. In this case, the law is very clear. Mr. Sullivan pled venue. It was objected to by the commission. The burden shifts to Mr. Sullivan to provide prima facie proof. But once he does, the issue's ended. Which brings me to my second point, and that is the trial court was absolutely correct in dismissing this case. The trial court found correctly that this is a legal action. Now, there was some discussion of whether or not, or some argument as to whether or not an effort by the Ethics Commission to prosecute someone for a violation which results only in a fine is a legal action. That's just not the case. Tull versus the United States, back in 1984, the United States Supreme Court that says any action, whether it's punitive or fine, that results in taking money from a defendant, is a legal action for which the defendant has a Seventh Amendment right to trial by jury. The statute specifically gives a respondent who appeals the right to trial by jury. Consequently, this is a legal action. You had asked earlier about administrative issues. Remember, the statute specifically says a legal action means a lawsuit, a cause of action, petition, complaint, cross-claim, counterclaim. It doesn't get into administrative. It has to be something brought in a court. And once you bring, this is the only way you can, through due process, deprive somebody of property is through a legal action. This is four square a legal action. And it's very important for the court to consider the exception to the statute. It's a very narrow exception, and it involves enforcement actions. And enforcement actions are defined in Chapter 571, Subchapter F. The Ethics Commission, as many state agencies, have no ability to enforce their orders. They can reach a final decision, and if you ignore it, there's nothing they can do except ask the Attorney General to file a lawsuit and enforce the order through a legal proceeding. That's an enforcement action. This action is determining whether or not a violation even occurred. That's a legal action to impose a fine. The cause of action is four square within the boundaries of the statute. So, when the judge determined that the statute applied, he made these considerations. The burden then shifts back to the Ethics Commission. to provide prima facie evidence of evidence of each element of their cause of action. Well, this they didn't do. They failed in their burden. The Ethics Commission just submitted a stack of documents that the commission considered and said, here's the record from below, except the commission's not a court of record. All of their evidence was as to the proceeding in the trial court, hearsay, and it was objected to as hearsay. It was objected to in writing and objected to again at the trial. The Ethics Commission never had any of those documents admitted. They should have been marked individually and admitted one at a time and let the trial court rule individually as opposed to en masse. Documents submitted en masse, as this court knows, is simply hearsay. It's outside. And the statute 571.133 is very specific. No action of the commission shall be considered by the trial court or put into evidence other than the fact that they reached a final decision which confers jurisdiction on the trial court. But what the commission did or what it considered is specifically excluded. A commission may, if they choose, reintroduce everything as this is a pure trial de novo. But the commission failed to do that. And the trial court recognized that. When it was making its ruling, it says, I find the commission failed to meet its burden. Even more importantly, the second reason why the trial court was correct was because Mr. Sullivan showed that he was an employee of a bona fide news media. The statute that the Ethics Commission seeks to impose on Mr. Sullivan by requiring him to register has an exemption. The government code 305.004A says if you are employed by, own or employed by, a newspaper, a TV station, a radio station, or a bona fide news media, you are exempt from registration. Mr. Sullivan pled and proved that he was employed by Empower Texans. Mr. Sullivan also offered the affidavit to the trial court of Mr. Mark Lisheron, who is an award-winning, lifelong journalist, someone who's even on the editorial board of the Austin American Statesman, who says, Empower Texans and the way they distribute and push out information in their blog is in fact new media. It is a new way that people receive media over their phones, through Twitter, through emails, through email blast. There's absence, so their content contains news, it contains opinion, it contains editorial. This, he's a member of a media, he's employed. None of this was controverted. The Ethics Commission did not controvert that at all. In fact, the trial court said, and I believe these were his exact words, I don't see how the media exception doesn't apply. So in light of the fact that the statute is four square, applies to this cause of action, that the Ethics Commission failed to provide any evidence, any admissible evidence, of a violation, and that the Ethics Commission failed to even address the affirmative defense of we're exempt under the statute, the trial court properly dismissed the cause of action. And then the third point I want to make is regarding attorney's fees. Upon dismissal, an award of cost and reasonable attorney's fees is mandatory. The statute says the court shall award cost and reasonable attorney's fees. The trial court in this case abused its discretion by not awarding any. Any is completely an abuse of discretion of the trial court. All the trial court had before it in this case was an uncontroverted affidavit on attorney's fees, and it was unobjected to. Therefore, reasonable attorney's fees were established as a matter of law. The trial court had an unobjected to, uncontroverted affidavit. That means that it was conclusively proved. The Ethics Commission didn't want to pay attorney's fees, and his argument was, well, you shouldn't have granted the motion to dismiss. understand that, but that's not how you respond to attorney's fees. The trial court was left in that situation with, if there was an issue, could have been addressed, but it wasn't. Accordingly, this court should reverse that portion of the judgment and render attorney's fees based upon the affidavit. Now, I want to leave the court with just one thought, and that it is fundamental in American under the United States Constitution that a person has a right to live anywhere they want, whenever they want, for whatever reason they want. Mr. Sullivan proved that he was a resident of Denton County. Mr. Sullivan met his burden under the motion to dismiss. Mr. Sullivan met his burden to prove up reasonable attorney's fees. For that reason, I would ask the court to affirm the trial court's decision on the motion to dismiss in reverse and render judgment in the attorney's fees and the amount proven in the affidavit.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Good closing, by the way. Would you address briefly why the Texas Ethics Commission did not, excuse me, have a right to have reconsideration by Judge Cleveland?
Well, they did, but they didn't make that motion. They waived it.
Okay.
The only thing that Judge Cleveland considered was Mr. Sullivan's motion to award attorney's fees. When Judge Cleveland signed the order denying the case, the dismissing the case and not awarding attorney's fees, within hours, the commission filed a notice of appeal. What it did not do was file a motion for a new trial or a motion for reconsideration. In fact, it's very interesting in this situation, from the conclusion of the initial hearing in front of Judge Burgess, Judge Burgess gave the commission 7 or 10 days, some amount of time to respond to the attorney's fees request. And instead, they recused Judge Burgess. So the only motion that was ever before Judge Cleveland was the motion to award attorney's fees.
Okay, thank you.
I have one follow-up question. Can you explain, as the appellant pointed out, that some of the quotes you all have regarding the media exception omit that last phrasing that comes after the comma? Why does that not apply to Mr. Sullivan?
Well, for two reasons. One is that there was no allegation that Mr. Sullivan was further engaged in any lobby activity. The other reason is, and we argued this a little bit to the trial court, and he chose to not address it. He goes, I'm not going to rule on the constitutionality basis. But the media exception is really a tautology. If you are engaged in activity which would require you to register as a lobbyist, you have to register, except if you're a member of the media, except if you are doing further activities, which kind of brings you back in a circle. But kind of like an insurance policy, when an insured has the burden of proof for an exclusion, if that exclusion doesn't apply. But if there's an exception to the exclusion, then it goes back to the insurance company. In this case, that exception to the exception goes back to the commission. And the commission never pled any facts. They said, well, you're lobbying for Aramco in addition to Empower Texans. There was never anything other than Mr. Sullivan is an employee of Empower Texans and is engaged in his media efforts, which we think fall into lobbying, but there was never anything to show the exception to the exception. So it clearly falls at the exception. That's why we didn't address any further the second part of that, because there's no real facts to show or indicate, nobody's alleged that he's done anything other than be president of Empower Texans. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nixon. I believe Ms. Sween is arguing now.
May it please the court. We have several points on rebuttal, and I'll try not to talk too quickly. First, I want to set the record straight. We did indeed file a motion for reconsideration, which is referenced in our appellant's brief. It's in the fifth volume of the clerk's record at 3621. But before we had a chance to even set it for a hearing, Mr. Sullivan filed that motion for attorney's fees, which was set with a week's notice. It was filed a week later. There was a hearing, which did not even give us time under the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code to file what would qualify as a controverting affidavit. So that is the only thing we can understand what he means when he says the affidavit was uncontroverted. We had no controverting affidavit because we had no opportunity to file one in the 14-day in advance of a hearing requirement under the rules. What we did argue to Judge Cleveland was that the entire premise of dismissing this lawsuit under the TCPA needed to be revisited. It was entirely inappropriate. Now, first, let me hop back to the venue before I run out of time. There's this fiction that's being perpetrated on the court that they had no cause of action. Yet in Mr. Sullivan's own pleading, which initiated this proceeding, he refers to it as a cause of action under Section 571.133 of the Government Code. It is an appeal, yes, but that is the cause of action which ripened when the commission entered its final order on July 21st. If the cause of action belonged to us and is the underlying offenses that were brought up in sworn complaints filed with the Ethics Commission about conduct in 2010 and 2011, well, then they really have no proof of residency in Denton County. They haven't even proffered any suggestion that there was a residency in 2010 and 11. The cause of action accrued on July 21st. This retroactive attempt to manufacture the appearance of venue must be rejected, or the rules are a fiction here. Residency is a legal term of art. It's not what a party declares it to be. And if we look at those cases upon which Mr. Sullivan relies, we see that the ability to establish a second permanent residence is a high bar. And in those few cases, like the Rosales versus HEB case, where a party successfully mustered a prima facie case, the evidence was overwhelming that there was a permanent residence where the party lived, and then he had another residence where he was temporarily working when he was injured. All right, and there were driver's license records, home records, et cetera, et cetera. Mr. Sullivan's affidavit is not prima facie evidence of residency in Denton County. Now, the other fiction here is that we can take out parts of a statute and, under the rules of statutory construction, ignore parts we don't like. We've seen that several times here. Yes, this is a legal action, but it's not a legal action seeking legal or equitable relief, which is what the TCPA requires. This is an action seeking an appeal of administrative agency's determination that resulted in a fine. Now, today, before the Texas Supreme Court, this issue of how civil penalties are distinct from damages and that's not legal remedies is actually a subject of appeal in Forte versus Walmart because it was a question certified from the Fifth Circuit. The state has always argued there's a distinction. Civil penalties are not legal remedies. But more importantly, you don't have a construction of a statute that results in an absurdity. And what we would have here is if Chapter 27 is intended to nullify a person's right to pursue a statutory appeal by simply saying, my First Amendment rights are oppressed by having to comply with state law, then anything can become an anti-SLAPP statute. But here we have an administrative agency charged by the state under the Government Code, Chapter 305, to enforce the laws, which is why there was a proceeding instituted against Mr. Sullivan. The proceeding had nothing to do with empowered Texans blogging, its journalistic activities. It was about those direct communications to specific legislatures, members of the House, their staff, which are in the record. They were put before Judge Burgess, and he elected not to consider them.
Let me ask you that. Question about that, because it's their position that the trial court could not consider those items that were considered by the TEC, and that this court cannot consider them, and that you didn't meet your burden when the burden shifted back to you. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, twofold response to that. First, if you look again at the statute that creates the right to a trial de novo, it does not say that the agency cannot rely on evidence adduced during the administrative proceeding. That would be an absurdity. The suggestion that we have to go invent new facts, find new witnesses, come up with new documents in order to retry our case.
Position. I think his position is you just have to reoffer it.
But we weren't even given that opportunity. There was no evidentiary hearing. And that's the second point, Your Honor, that the TCPA, as the Supreme Court recently emphasized in Lipsky, does not require an evidentiary hearing. All the statute mentions are pleadings and affidavits. So we were not given the opportunity to present evidence. We filed a responsive brief to which we attached responsive evidence, which based on the review of every single TCPA case I've looked at, that's what people do. Judges don't hold evidentiary hearings where individual exhibits are offered, objections are heard, etc., and the trial court here did not do that. The idea, though, that he was supposed to, and that he wasn't, that we hadn't come forward with anything that would be admissible, is something that it does not resemble any civil proceeding I'm aware of. If we had evidence that we tried to get admitted, if you read the record, there was no chance to let us admit evidence. It was just told that you can't look at that judge because it was used in the administrative proceeding. So we object to this, all that evidence wholesale. That was the argument. And the argument here is that is somehow justified by the statute 571.133. But all that statute says is you can't admit the final decision of the agency for obvious reasons. That would prejudice the fact finder if you said, here, look, we already concluded this person violated the rules, and here's everything we did. But there was no trial de novo. And we've heard that, again, this is another fiction that seems to permeate the briefing as if there was a trial de novo. This hasn't happened yet. There was no evidentiary proceeding of any kind.
All right, Ms. Swain, hate to cut you off, but we are out of time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
We appreciate everybody's arguments today and all the briefing. The court did also receive an amicus brief just moments before we started court. I've been told it's 600 pages, so we haven't read that, although I'm sure a lot of it is appendices and whatnot, but we will review those as well. And we appreciate all of your arguments today, as well as all of your briefing to this court. So your case is now submitted, and we will recess court for a few minutes until 3 o'clock.